And I want to thank Pastor Gully for his invitation to talk. He said that we're supposed to talk about, at this moment, what I believe to be the most important virtue for America and for us as Americans. It's a way of a prompt. He said, fill in the blank. If America were great, it would. So I'm going to address that question. So I noticed when I was given the date July 14th that today is Bastille Day. So happy Bastille Day to everyone. As you may know, it celebrates the day July 14th, 1789, when the people of Paris, intoxicated, according to a 19th century historian, with liberty and enthusiasm, stormed the Bastille, and it's celebrated because it was a turning point for the French Revolution and a solidifying moment for the French people. So I thought it seemed appropriate to, on this day, thank the French for financing our revolution. Many believe that we wouldn't be here today without them. Now, Bastille Day and the French Revolution followed closely on the heels of the initiation of the newly constituted America. And I'm not a student of French history or the French Revolution, so I'll leave it to others to tell us whether the French financed the American Revolution because they believed in the democratic enlightenment principles that inspired America's revolutionaries, or whether it was a French power move to spite their rivals, the British. Or historians just may tell us that it's just the French were intoxicated on good French wine and American tobacco when Ben Franklin and John Adams charmed them into writing big checks. Well, we'll leave another day to debate that. What I do know is that the American Revolution that the French financed was also fueled by audacious ambition. And in the spring of 1789, just a few months before the storming of the Bastille, the American people must have similarly been high on liberty and enthusiasm when they commenced their endeavor to form a more perfect union. Our greatness, if achievable, depends on our ambition and endurance for holding ourselves accountable to America's potential. And that is the virtue that I think that we need at this moment of our American history. We need the ambition to live up to our potential. So the language of ambition and potential is everywhere in our founding documents. The Declaration of Independence in 1776, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that it is the right of the people to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form. So those are lofty goals, ambitious. All men are created equal. That we're endowed with certain rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? We don't have a right to happiness, but we have the right to pursue happiness, aspire to happiness. So then 20 years later, 20 years of war with the British and 20 years of political arm wrestling amongst ourselves, the Constitution went into effect in 1789. And the Constitution's goals are summarized in its preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense. If you have a constitution, you can read along. Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for our prosperity. So those are more lofty goals, ambitious, unprecedented, to form a more perfect union. Not perfect, not to form a perfect union, but a constant process of attainment, a pursuit that we, the people, will strive to perfection, and that we'll establish justice. And we know that justice is never a static notion, that it is always situational. And secure the blessings of liberty, not just for ourselves, but for our posterity, right? So that's aspirational, that we make sure that what we do today will secure liberty, those blessings of liberty, for not just our children, but for our posterity. So that ambitious language has inspired our leaders throughout our American history. So because of, for instance, because of its aspirational goal, JFK called America perpetually redeemable. Everywhere in our national ethos is that sense, that of that energy of unrealized potential. We've achieved so much at that moment and in moments in between, and yet we can achieve so much more if we put our minds have equal power. Our belief that government is going to hold true to these principles. And once we, and we can, and we see the problem, and so then we become disillusioned, we stop voting, and Indiana is one of the worst states in the country for the percentage of people who vote. And thus that gives more rein to the those who are elected and who are elected by a slimmer and slimmer minority, a more and more fringe voice, which is exactly the problem with political gerrymandering and why it's such a threat to our democracy. I think that most people believed that it was a huge long shot, especially for this court. I mean, this conservative court asking them to challenge the domain. I mean, that's clearly the domain of another legislative branch. Also, you know, the 15th Amendment, talking about the right to vote, I think is the only time that the Constitution talks about the right to vote. You know, it's our democracy is so intertwined with the notion of voting, right? We the people, be able to ordain our government. But because it's not mentioned in the Constitution, because they assumed that, of course, you know, it's there, it's everywhere. It's been ceded to the state government. So when you had that combined, the fact that it's a right that in most instances has been said states can do pretty much what they want about the vote, you know, the hours of voting, who can vote vis-a-vis incarcerate people who've been convicted of a crime, you know, how you vote mail-in, standing in line, what kind of machines, that's all ceded to the government, to the state government. So when you had that whole line of principles that voting is a state, is how you vote is a state domain, and then coupled with this legislative process, and you had a one branch telling another branch potentially what to do, people weren't surprised that the Supreme Court backed off. But you know, there have been attempts before, and you know, I think that people really had a faith in science and in data that finally we had a way of proving the real effects of gerrymandering, and I think that's why people got their hopes up this time. Because, I mean, it is undeniable, and the justices didn't deny. They recognized, they admitted that it has a negative impact on voting because it makes it futile for so many people. It effectively disenfranchises them. But they said it's not our job. So now it's, we gotta push the legislatures in all 50 states. Yeah. And some states have done it, right? Some states have nonpartisan commissions.
Do you think that GOP's push to get the citizen question on the census is being done as a step towards changing representation in Congress so that the number of representatives will be according to citizens, and so it would eliminate counting not just undocumented immigrants, but immigrants that are here legally and are apt to be working and going to school and so forth, living here too. And
right.
Definitely affected by laws that would be passed.
So I think that's the speculation, and certainly the letters, documentation by the social scientist who worked a lot on designing the modern, the evilly effective modern gerrymandering. That's what his private papers showed, right? And the Supreme Court didn't take that into account. That evidence came out after the evidence was before them. But they decided on the census, to deny the census, disallow the ability to add the citizenship question because the process was flawed and pretextual, right? So, and because what we do know, what was before the court, was that the evidence shows that the Census Bureau decided to drop the citizenship question because it discouraged participation. And the Supreme Court also knew that the constitutional mandate for a decennial census is very clear that it is not to be limited to citizens. So those things to combine, the Constitution is trying to count all people, not just those who are citizens, and that the Census Bureau, which was one of the most professionally protected federal agencies up to this point, I think they fought valiantly against this administration to the degree that they could. Those statisticians said, we're going to drop it because it hurts the count and it hurts the constitutional purpose of a decennial. And we can get that same information more accurately with the other censuses that we take between the decennial census. So, I mean, in my heart of hearts, do I think they did it to depress and rearrange the representation so that they could have, they could do more gerrymandering to the Republican benefit? Absolutely. That's what I believe in my heart and heart. But we didn't even have to prove that for the court to say that it was illegitimate what they were trying to do. Does that answer your question? Yeah, but the court often does that, right? I mean, that's why legal cases are so persnickety about standard of review, and why, I mean, the ACLU and its partners knew they had a challenge in structuring the legal argument, and so under the Administrative Act, which was one of the ways to combat what the federal government was trying to do. I mean, I'm not sure that Roberts was wrong in the way saying that. I mean, he was definitely right that they failed to comply with the administrative code. There's a lot of discretion that the Constitution explicitly and our case law implicitly has given the executive branch. And so, yet, that this administration so clearly violates even that broad discretion shows just how out of the norm they are.
I know in Pennsylvania, the state constitution did some things that they could stop gerrymandering. Does the Indiana state constitution have anything like that?
So some people are looking at that. So, I mean, there's really two things you have to look at for when you ask that question state by state. What is in the state constitution, and what has been the interpretation, historical interpretation, and role of the state judiciary in interpreting the state constitution. Our Supreme Court historically has been very, very, very circumspect in its role vis-a-vis the legislative or the legislative process. So for instance, we bring 99.9% of our cases in federal court under the federal constitution. A recent exception to that was we brought a case under state law against the Department of Child Welfare. I'm getting the name of the agency wrong, because the state legislature had mandated in 2014, 13, a cap on the number of children that can be in any one caseworker's caseload. And they had caseloads that were double that, right? So we brought a case on behalf of several caseworkers saying that asking the court to hold the legislature in violation of the executive branch in violation of the legislative branch's law, right? Which they clearly were. Indiana Supreme Court said clearly they were. They said, not our job.
And I sat across from Bonaventure one evening and hear her talking about that. There was no reason for that, and she was going to have a case of which she wanted. And she was very blatant.
Right. So in light of that, I have very little hope that our Indiana Supreme Court will find gerrymandering to be in violation of our state constitution.
One other corrective exists, then, if the judicial branch won't hold the executive branch accountable.
So here we have a little bit of history of how Indiana works, right? And it's not encouraging, but it's not hopeless. So we're just late adapters, right? So all the states that can easily adopt nonpartisan commissions have or are in the process of doing so. Then you have a lot of the states. I mean, you can probably map that this course by comparing it to the course on any number of laws, whether it's marriage equality or any number of lesser famous examples. And so there's going to be a whole spate of states that are second adapters, right? And Indiana will be in that, probably in that last category of five or so states that can no longer feel like they can go against history and the norm. And so they'll feel that they have that will give weight to citizens who now and by that point will have for many, many years been pushing for nonpartisan commissions. And you know, maybe that'll be enough, that combined they're tired of being one of the few who don't have them, combined with the fact that we'll feel like, you know, will shame them into passing it. That's my prediction.
We have time for one more, and I see Bill's got the microphone.
Yeah, and that kind of pushes us a little forward. If we look forward to the time when this executive is no longer in power, which, you know, let's hope that's soon, we still have a thing that's happened that I think changes our perspective on the way the courts would intervene, and that's the number of Federalist Society judges that have been put in place at the lower levels of the federal courts. I think I know throughout my lifetime, it seems to me that the usual path of things has been that we've depended on progressive change taking place quickly because the courts can overturn things based on the 14th Amendment or other aspects of the Constitution much more quickly than we can get legislative action. And the way I'm looking at things now is I feel like we're not going to be able to count on that as much in the future. What kind of things should we be doing? One, in order to make sure those of us who think that's the way it's supposed to work don't go crazy because it kind of stops working that way. But two, how should we be in a state like Indiana where we've kind of depended on that being the only way to feel like our voices are being heard? What should we be doing going forward? How should we be thinking about these things? Where do we put our efforts?
So I have a couple of thoughts. One, I want to inject a little optimism, whether it's, you know, lawyerly self-delusion or not. I mean, we have a lot of faith in the courts, right? And President Trump and Mitch McConnell are not the first to install judges that they thought reflected their view of the world and of the Constitution. And still, that progression of interpretation of the Constitution hasn't progressed in fits and starts, you know, a step back, but mostly two steps forward, right? So we've survived it in the past.
I think the most important thing is to install good judges,
and I think that goes a long way, right? And you know, we need to watch, as people have, you know, what the role of precedent remains, right? Because that'll shore up and keep from whipshine back and forth. And we as Americans, even though we can't directly influence specific cases, we can be voices for that moderate approach toward judicial interpretation. I mean, the reason why the concept of precedent exists is to allow some stability for society, right? So you don't have to worry that every 4 years you're going to get new judges who think different ways, and you can't construct a life, a business, because you don't know how the law is going to change, right? So understanding that and being a proponent of it. I'd say the other thing, and the ACLU is nonpartisan, but I would say it matters who controls the Senate. And I personally think, and also as the ACLU, I mean, Mitch McConnell denying a hearing of a nominee by a sitting president, and I've talked about it, I've talked within the office about, like, you know, can you impeach a senator? I mean, and that was clearly unconstitutional. Clearly, that was outrageous. And he continues his job, one that he says it is, and his progress has demonstrated his job one is to fill all the vacancies that he created by denying to fill for the last 2.5 years of President Obama's in the lower courts. So change the Senate, for God's sake. Change the Senate. I think that's the other thing people can do.
All right, I'd like to thank you, Jane, this evening. Let's give her a round of And I'll remind you of our next program, which is on your sheet. Amalka Bird will be speaking on July 28th. And now I would like to invite everyone downstairs for refreshments, and you can continue the conversations. Thanks.